Hey gang, it's an editor's note from your pal Nathan. There should have been an episode last week, and there isn't because I got high and forgot about it, I think. So that's my bad. Sorry about that. The gang did their jobs properly. Your old pal just dropped the ball. So won't happen again. Again, I get one every like 3 years or so. Give me some slack. But this episode will be coming up. And as a mea culpa, as myself crit for doing this, I will offer you a one time only. Shut up and let the book do the talking, gang. See you guys later. Bye.
Welcome back to Mark's Madness, now part of Chunkaluta.
Hello.
Shumanitu's cold opens have got them unable to make the podcast. No, it has nothing to do with the cold opens, but Shumanitu's unable to make it today, but we are recording again. So once again, we've had to kill off a member, vote off a member of the island, and we're back with
you. They do not care about you, so we got rid of them for sending out job applications for their replacement.
But anyway, welcome back to Mark's Madness, part of Chunkaluta Network. We're going to jump back into the Modern Prince, which Prez here has put together for it's put into a reader that they've put together for us. And we will be jumping back in slide 185. And that is why one's concept of what a party is paragraph. Before we go into that, again, new show, not up and running. So instead of having current events either not come up or come up as appropriate during the reading, we just want to get a couple out of the way that, you know, just the ones that we feel like we should say something on. Like if we get done recording, we say nothing about that. It feels wrong type stuff. So not every current event, obviously, you know, there's still turmoil in Haiti going down because of the U.S. coup 20 years ago and the consistent consequences after that, and the U.S. more and more pretending to be the solution, really just going in there to put down, you know, people's revolts. Obviously, the millions displaced in Sudan and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, constant, you know, consequences of climate change. All of these things are still, but not day to day. You know, the concentration camps on the borders, the conditions in the reservations that makes them concentration camps. All of these things are constant things we need to talk about, but just the acute current events that we need to bring up. And the one that we should really talk about is Biden is building a port in Israel.
You're welcome. For people who think the U.S. isn't doing anything, you're welcome.
So yeah, after the U.S., you know, dropped 38,000 meals for 2 million people that have been starving for several days. That definitely were not expired and actually killed a couple people on impact coming down. As well as I think, was that in on the aid that, or was it just the other flower aid that Israel was firing on when it was dropped? I think that was in on the aid too. So essentially worked as bait for Israel to just massacre hungry civilians. You know, this fucking horrible gesture, made to look like, you know, saviorism while they arm and, you know, Israel and are paying for the bombs that are just destroying infrastructure and people's lives. While this is all happening, Biden is building a port, which surely is just putting a U.S. military base in Israel. Let's just spell that out very clearly. That is not going to do anything for the Palestinians. It is not going to slow or even temper the genocide one bit. It is just the U.S. using the genocide as an excuse to put up another military base in West Asia before, I guess, really thinking Israel kind of was their military base in that region, and now just more explicitly building their own to try to look like a good guy, which tells me that the United States is very, very concerned about the entire Arabian Peninsula, or, you know, most of West Asia, North Africa, getting to a point where they will go to war with Israel, which tells me Israel fully anticipates finishing the ethnic cleansing of Gaza and then expanding the war to other horizons, and that flaring up a regional war. And the U.S. is preparing for that instead of leaving Israel to be the military base because they don't think Israel will survive it. But that somehow will get spun as some kind of humanitarian thing for Palestinians, which of course will take a very long time, is done with the permission of Israel, who U.S. is still arming to fucking commit the genocide, and who the U.S. could just tell to let in all of the sufficient aid that is sitting at the border being blocked out by Israel right now. They're going to build the fucking port. So again, you know, just using it as an excuse. It's, and I was talking to Prez about it before when they brought up the port. We were discussing things before the episode. It makes me think of how, you know, the Democrats get to look like the good guys, like they care about climate change by saying it's a matter of national security. And what that really means is they're just, you know, in an arms race on the border with Republicans. Republicans, of course, do their thing. They make outrageous, you know, genocidal, horrific, untenable policies and demands and scream that the Democrats are doing nothing because they don't do it. Meanwhile, the actual policies that come up with it that can ram through that are horrendously right wing, the Democrats are fully on board enthusiastically with all of it based on all of their talk around it. All because of their own personal ideology, but they act like it's making tough choices and compromising with Republicans and a bunch of gotchas for hypocrisy that will somehow save the world. Now, because the Democrats get to be the humanitarian ones, while the Republicans are screaming to be more rabidly pro-Israel as this genocide is happening and Biden is fully backing it, the U.S. is pretending like they're caring about humanitarian aid when they're really just further entrenching the settler colonialism in Israel by building a military base there. But, you know, hey, port.
And it's not ever going to see a single thing of aid.
Yeah, no, not one bit. Not one bit. The only aid that would ever go through there, if it ever does, would come through USAID. And while once in a blue moon, when the attacked population is sufficiently powerless and attacked by other U.S. allies, the U.S. will send actual aid in USAID. Largely, it's just a front for like CIA, you know, wrecking and harm done, and it being done through this port, again, hence military base. This is not a fucking, you know, that's what this is, right? You know, being done through this, it's just more explicit. There's definitely not going to be fucking aid going through there, not in a million years.
See, like, that's the problem with all of these NGOs. Like, you know, on their face, and a lot of the people in them are doing something or attempting to do something that is on its face good, like trying to
get
women access to healthcare in places where they don't legally have access or options. But yeah, like, fucking, even the ones that aren't, like, excuse me, like, USAID is part of the U.S. government, even if it's not, like,
right,
even if we don't know the whole
part, and
even if we don't know the whole quote about how it's an arm of the government.
Wasn't there an explicit Reagan CIA quote?
Yeah.
I was going to say the explicit Reagan quote that was there to whitewash the CIA, like, just said it.
Even if we don't have that quote, like, if we're looking at some of these, like, international organizations, like Doctors Without Borders, or there's another one.
Well, I even think a lot of these, like, I mean, there's some quote unquote human rights think tanks, because of course they're all going to be funded, that are just like flat out CIA front shit. But a lot of these, you know, really pro US regime change, wheel greasing, you know, and human rights style NGOs are probably people that genuinely just think the US are good guys in spite of the evidence hitting them in the face, and that all these official enemies are bad guys because, you know, they've been poisoned ideologically from that, but they're trying to do some good and promote human rights or whatever the fuck, right? And so then that's where you'll get them like calling out each other's bad propaganda, of course, after the damage is done. Like Human Rights Watch calling out Amnesty, or no, it was Amnesty calling Human Rights Watch in Libya. which one this time? But then both of those groups, of course, you know, openly being like, hey, this is a fucking genocide in Palestine, and calling out for Palestinians. Like, that's the vestiges of that idea. And really, it's the at large, the world view of what the Democratic Party sells, right? It's, you know, combat the bad things. Obviously, there's these objectively bad things we can agree on, like genocide bad, racism is bad, but you combat it by.
So like the, I dropped out because I really had to look up the name. So like there's this nonprofit Save the Children, which is like,
oh yeah,
not at all political. They literally do like Doctors Without Borders stuff where they just provide medical care, but all of this stuff is so intertwined with the UN, with the US, with the international funding structure, that they were the group that fucking helped the CIA find bin Laden. And like, even the people who are trying to do good work are fucked. The US's tentacles are everywhere. And even when the people who are trying to do something good get involved with something that is slightly involved with the US, they're just absolutely tainted. So anything that is actually directly involved with the US is just absolutely fucking evil.
Yep. And in between you have, of course, the NGOs that are just, you know, some rich person's projects.
Just tax breaks and regime change operations.
Yeah, exactly. Been that way since Charlie Wilson. Been that shit since Charlie Wilson, you know. But yeah, a lot of these NGOs, they're not combating things. They think they are, they try to, but they trust these colonial systems. And if you combat the products of colonialism that are bad, you know, fascism, genocide, racism, with these colonial systems, sometimes just the formality of it and the people getting behind it will temper things a little bit, which is kind of good. But on the whole, they're going to uphold the cause of all these problems, which in turn exacerbates and prolongs them. All right. Well, then I will take over. We're on slide 185 in the Modern Prince. That is why one's concept of what a party is and ought to be results from the way in which one writes the history of a party. And we've just gone over how about the history and the conditions around a party are important to identify what a party is and its ideology, right? Which we've talked about that, you know, like if you just made a scale of left to right wing, because there's a lot of people think that's just some magic scale, right? Like Guaido would be left of Bernie and all he was like a right wing colonial fucking wrecker, you know? The conditions and what the presence of that party or that politician means makes a huge difference in context. The sectarian will rejoice in minor internal facts, which will have for him an esoteric significance and will fill him with mystical enthusiasm. The historian, however, who gives to everything the importance which it has in the general picture, will concentrate above all on the real efficacy of the party, on its determining power, positive or negative, and having contributed to creating an event or in having prevented other events from coming about. Can't just save CPUSA because it's in the name. The history matters. The point of knowing when a party was formed, i.e. acquired a precise and permanent task, gives rise to many discussions and often also only too often to a form of arrogance, which is no less ridiculous and dangerous than the national arrogance of which Vico speaks. True, it can be said that a party is never completely formed in the sense that every development creates new tasks and functions, and in the sense that for certain parties, the paradox is true that they are completed and formed only when they no longer exist, i.e. when their existence has become historically useless. Thus, since every party is only a class nomenclature, it is evident that for the party which sets itself to abolish the division into classes, its perfection and completion consists in no longer existing, since classes and therefore their expressions no longer exist. But here I want to emphasize a particular stage in this process of development, the stage following that in which a fact may or may not exist, in the sense that the necessity for its existence has not yet become peremptory, but depends in great part on the existence of persons of extraordinary willpower. The point about national arrogance by Vico, not remembering far back enough, which, what was that?
I do not know.
Oh, okay. Is this a Gramsci Dome thing?
This is like a Gramsci callback.
Oh. Okay. Yeah. That's
Vico's like a super common Italian name, so I can't even like.
That's good. So if I'm understanding that last sentence, though, especially when we're using fancy words like peremptory, which is, in my understanding, like there can be no doubt. It can only be this. There's no will to change. Right. Or it's not going to change. It is how it is in a word, in a fancy scholastic word. But when it's not yet become peremptory, when it's not yet solidified, this is what the party is. It depends in great part on the extraordinary persons of willpower, essentially the leadership or people who seize leadership of the party, right? The people who drive it. It doesn't matter. You can't say this is the party's philosophy forever and ever. If the party still exists and still is necessary, is not a historical relic, then it can always change directions based on who is leading it. Is that the correct reading of that? Because that's how I got that.
Yeah, the party is never a fixed thing. It will always change based on the ideology and culture of the time and the people who shape it.
Mm-hmm.
We shouldn't be dogmatists about the party.
Yep. Nope.
Unlike some people.
I think that's a good way to lay out why and how we shouldn't be dogmatists about a party rather than just saying it. Because if you just say it, we shouldn't be dogmatists about a party. Like, that's one of those, like, you shouldn't trust the media. You can pull it any right wing direction. But if you're saying, well, no, I mean, the party can never like crystallize as this is what it is until it stops existing, until it's a historical relic. It's about the ideas and people running it. And so what are the ideas and people running it? Not what is this crystallized idea you have of this party?
Yeah. I mean, if the whole concept, if the very basis of the concept of the vanguard is that it's supposed to be the most progressive elements of the people, then you can't be dogmatic about that because you will always be the people.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to be dogmatic about it, you're going to remove yourself from the people and you will no longer be people.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
You will then become elitist bureaucrats like the Soviet Union.
You're saying Gramsci had a specific critique in mind here.
Yes, he might have.
No, but that, like any good theory, it's something that makes sense intuitively as soon as it's said to you. You just never would have thought of it. So thank you, Gramsci. When does a party become historically necessary? When the conditions for its triumphs, for its inevitable assumptions of state power, are at least in process of formation and allow the further developments to be not normally foreseen. But then can one say in these conditions that a party cannot be destroyed by normal means? To answer this is necessary to the development of the argument. In order that a party shall exist, and the conversion of three fundamental elements, i.e. three groups of elements, is necessary. Number one, a widespread element of common average men whose participation is provided by discipline and faith, not by a creative and highly organizational spirit. Without these, the party would not exist. It is true, but it is also true that the party would not exist only with these. They are a force insofar as there is someone who centralizes, organizes, and disciplines them. And in the absence of force, they would break up and cancel each other out in scattered impotence. I do not deny that every one of these elements could become a cohesive force, but we are speaking of them precisely at a stage where they are this and are not in a condition to be so, or if they are only as a restricted circle, politically ineffective and inconsequential. So again, you need the bulk of the party who's not necessarily just the leadership, right? People who would go to action but wouldn't call the action themselves. Or who just kind of, you know, passively participate. You do need some amount of of that, which is a kind of fun little microcosm of the fact that, like, revolution, you do need the party to lead the way, but you don't need, like, the whole population to be in the party, but you're also not going to do like, you know, 70% of Americans want universal health care. Well, there's no, you know, there's no vanguard that's politically relevant enough to accomplish that. So it just kind of sits there, right? And undemocratically never happens. So you need both the populace who would go along with it, in this case, more specifically, populace motivated enough to be party members and participate, but not necessarily the vanguard or within the party leadership. Two, the principal cohesive element, which centralizes in the national field, which renders effective and powerful the totality of forces, which left to themselves would count for nothing or very little. This element is endowed with a highly cohesive, centralizing, and disciplinary power, which is also, perhaps because of this, inventive. If what is meant is inventive in a certain direction according to certain lines of force, certain perspectives, and certain premises. I would like to know if that parentheses was Gramsci or was the translator. It is also true that this element alone would not form a party, but it would do so more than the first element. They would be generals without an army, but in reality, it is easier to create an army than create generals. It is equally true that an already existing army is destroyed if the generals disappear. Well, the existence of a group of generals trained to work together in agreement among themselves with common ends is not slow to form an army, even when where none exists. This is the part of the parties that, you know, operations like COINTELPRO would go after. And three, a middle element that links the first element with the second and puts them into contact, not only physically, but morally and intellectually. In fact, for every party, there exists definite proportions between these three elements, and the greatest effectiveness is achieved with these definite proportions when these definite proportions are realized. Given these conditions, one can say that a party cannot be destroyed by normal means, since if there necessarily exists the second element, whose origin is tied to the existence of objective material conditions, although in a dispersed and vague state, and if this second element does not exist, all argument is pointless, then the other two elements cannot help being formed, i.e. the first element, which is necessarily forms the third as its continuation and means of expression. For this to come about, and that's the end of the three bullet points, the three sections, groups of elements of a party. For this to come about, it is necessary that the iron conviction be formed that a certain solution to vital problems is necessary. Without this conviction, the second element, whose destruction is easier on account of its smaller numbers, will not be formed. But it is necessary that the second element, if destroyed, leaves an inheritance, a ferment from which it can be reformed. And wherein can this ferment exist better and be able to form itself better than in the first and third elements, which evidently are the most homogeneous with the second? The activity of the second element to this constitute this is therefore fundamental. The criterion of judgment of what second element is to be looked for, one, in what it actually does, two, what it prepares on hypothesis for its own destruction, of the two facts is difficult to say which is more important. Since defeat in the struggle must always be foreseen, the preparation of its own successors must be of equal importance with what is done for victory. I do like that I just mentioned COINTELPRO, and Gramsci was like, by the way, here's how you solve that, before I even got there and before Gramsci saw such things firsthand.
It's almost like he was living under a fascist dictatorship.
That's true. Well, he was part of the second element, and he was chucked into prison. Yeah. As regards to party arrogance, this may be said to be worse than the national arrogance of which Vico speaks. Why? Because a nation cannot help existing, and in fact, that it exists, it is always possible, even with goodwill and bringing forward of authorities, to find that this existence is full of destiny and significance. And to be clear for people who are confused, a nation always can't help but existing. A state can help but existing. A nation cannot. And we would go back to the national question on that to understand that. But basically, it's a group of people with similar regions, backgrounds, social interests, things like that. On the other hand, a party can cease to exist by its own act. It must never be forgotten that in the struggle between nations, it is the interest of each nation that the others should be weakened by internal struggles, and that the parties are precisely the elements of internal struggles. For the parties, therefore, it is always possible to ask whether they exist by their own powers as real necessity, or whether they exist for the interest of others. In fact, in polemics, this point is never forgotten. Rather, it is a persistent theme, especially when the reply is not in doubt, which means that it has been in doubt, but is so no longer. I wonder, so I just made that comment, and I meant it with the difference between a state and a nation, but then Gramsci continued talking in a way that really felt like nation was still equated to state, which, I mean, people do talk like that at times. So I wonder if that was just the translator picking a similar word and me stating something true, but not something Gramsci felt or meant here. Or if that was, you know, just Gramsci being very realistic that a non-state nation is not really realistically feasible for the purposes of writing this. So why go into those details? I don't know. But that would be interesting. But obviously, I'm not on the same page as I was going on there.
So I looked up who this Vico dude is.
Yeah.
And when I said it was a callback, oh boy, was it a callback.
Oh boy.
Gramsci is referring to Giambattista Vico, who was alive from 1668 to 1744.
Okay.
And this dude essentially argued that rationalism would cause national arrogance.
Oh. Oh, I think something was said about that before, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And he also was the first one to argue that humanity is a type of science. So, actually, kind of interesting, but seems like he founded social science in a way, but this was quite a callback.
Yeah, that is quite a callback.
It's one of those times where that joke that if you're a Marxist, you have to know the name of everyone in existence to know what someone you're reading is talking about.
Gramsci actually did that. So yeah, off the dome. Okay. So, but that puts into perspective, the idea of, you know, the arrogance of a secular state, and you can see that in the West, right? There's still a martyrdom to it, martyrdom complex to it. But the arrogance of that, of like, you are right because you believe in the great state, rather than, you know, in the great rationalism or whatever. It's worse to be blind as a party. And I just jumped page. Nope. There we go. I'm back. But that's an interesting thought. Okay. Where was I? Naturally, the person who lets himself be torn into pieces by these doubts would be a fool. Politically, the question has only a momentary relevance. In the history of the so-called principle of nationality, foreign interventions in favor of national parties, which disturbed the internal order of antagonistic states, are innumerable. So much so that when we speak, for example, of Cavour's Eastern policy, we wonder whether we were speaking of a permanent line of action or of a stratagem of the moment to weaken Austria in view of 1859 and 1866. Thus, the Mazzinian movement in the early 1870s, for example, the Barsanti affair, we see that the intervention of Bismarck, who, in view of the war with France and the danger of the Franco-Italian alliance, thought to weaken Italy by internal conflicts. Thus, in the events of June 1914, some see the intervention of the Austrian general staff in light of the war to come. As we see, the causality takes many forms, and it is necessary to have clear ideas about it. Admitted that whatever one does, one always plays somebody's game. The important thing is to seek in every way to play one's own game, i.e. to win completely. Anyway, we must despise party arrogance and substitute for it concrete facts. Those who substitute arrogance for facts or carry on a policy of arrogance are certainly to be suspected of very little seriousness. It is not necessary to add that it is essential for parties to avoid even the justified appearance of playing somebody else's game, especially if the somebody is a foreign state. But if someone tries to exploit this, nothing can be done about it. I guess this is saying, like, responding to some kind of accusations that Italian communists were supporting Germany in some way in 1914. Am I reading that right? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Which, I mean, makes sense. You saw the same accusations for, like, Bolsheviks in Russia and stuff, you know? But obviously, that's a good point. They wouldn't want to actually support Bismarck, right? Like, communists are going to be unfairly stumping for Putin, but we wouldn't actually want to go out and fight for Putin type thing.
Well, you say that, but given the state of discourse I see from certain American leftists.
Yeah. That's, again, this entire book is about Potsies. Let's be real. It is difficult to include the fact that some political parties of the ruling group, but also of subordinate groups, also fulfill a police function, that is, one of tutelage to a certain political and legal order. If this were shown with precision, the question would have to be posed in other terms, i.e., about the ways and directions in which this function comes to be exercised. Is the sense repressive or propagandistic, i.e., is it of a reactionary or progressive character? Does the given party exercise its police function by conserving an external, extrinsic order as tethering the rope to the live forces of history? Or does it do so by aiming to raise the people to a new level of civilization whose political and legal order is a programmatic expression? In fact, a law finds out the people who break it. One, among the socially reactionary elements whom the law is dispossessed. Two, among the progressive elements who the law represses. Three, among the elements who have not reached the level of civilization which the law may represent. The police function of a party can therefore be progressive or regressive. It is progressive when it aims to keep the reactionary forces inside the orbit of legality and to raise the backward masses to the level of new legality. It is regressive when it aims to repress the live forces of society and maintain a superseded anti-historic legality which has become extrinsic. For the rest of the function of a given party furnishes discriminating criteria. When a party is progressive, it functions democratically in accordance with the democratic centralism. When it is regressive, it functions bureaucratically in the sense of a bureaucratic centralism. The party in this second case is purely executive, not deliberative, and then technically a police organization, and its name of political party is pure mythological metaphor.
Who is he talking about?
I'm more worried about how can we apply that today in a way that makes sense. You know, like, if your party is not, you know, fighting for colonized people and trans people and fighting for land back, you know, and you can police people, so that
I think we need to make sure not to make the mistake of using progressive and repressive and police.
Oh, okay. As
literally.
Yeah.
Well, the way that he's using it is different.
Okay.
So when he talks about progressive and repressive and, you know, the regressive elements, he's talking about, you know, reactionary forces. But when he's talking about police, he's talking about, you know, enforcing the party line or bringing people into the fold of the party line when they're disagreeing with the party line. So he's talking about we've kind of already touched upon this in the reading already and this specific essay, but also the rest of the book. Like, the party is the party, and it's also civil society in general. So when he's talking about police, he's not talking about police. He's talking about how do we get people to agree with the political stance of the party itself through education, through media, through, you know, all the million different ways that the state apparatus functions. And how do we kind of, you know, peacefully snack people into place when they disagree with that.
Well, I guess that's where I was trying to say, like, you know, the progressive element. I mean, maybe I'm overprescribing progressive here, but, you know, the element of like supporting land back and colonized people and trans people, like, how do we get people in line for that, you know? And I think when I described it before I even came off, and she might have called me out immediately of, you know, still sounding very, punitive about it. Right. When, you know, we're abolitionists in that sense, but I think that's what I'm getting. Like the party's good if it's like, you know, getting people to combat racism and, you know, colonialism and combat poverty and things like that. And it's bad when it's, you know, getting people to, you know, necessarily like throw colonized or oppressed people or under the bus or any of these, you know, reactionary xenophobic ideologies, in the name of like, you know, past reactionary politics seeping into the party. Right.
Well, yeah, but we to kind of.
I guess I'm just trying to scratch what I said that made you say that, so I'm understanding you correctly.
I'm trying to think of how to explain it. So the way that Gramsci is trying to conceptualize the state, when we think of the state, we think of the government, right?
Yeah.
And we think of the things in the government.
Mm-hmm.
And usually people think of, you know, the federal government, the legislature, and then the army, the police. And then if you're, you know, I'm going to use this very loosely, so don't take it very strictly, but like if you're being smart, you're thinking of like, you know, the bureaucracy and the schools and the library and government funded shit.
Mm-hmm.
What Gramsci is conceptualizing as the state is that stuff, and also the media, pretty much all aspects of life. So when I'm not just talking about media, I'm talking about, you know, and also he categorizes these things differently. So he uses political and civil. Mm-hmm. And he splits them differently. So the political is like the legislature and the police and the military, and the civil is education, certain aspects of the bureaucracy, like the train conductors, the media. So when he's talking about like how do we get people to understand what the party stands for, how do we teach people this new culture that the party is bringing?
And this is, know, why it's like, important to understand culture and intellectuals.
Yeah,
and
like that whole like it's not repressive in the sense of like if let's say tomorrow there's a revolution. Somehow there's a communist party that is able to take control. And let's say that starting tomorrow, there's a big anti-pollution campaign in the US on everything. Like one of the best things that has ever been done, you know, when we roll our eyes, was anti-smoking campaign in the U.S.
Yeah.
And also the give a hoot, don't pollute, Smokey the Bear shit.
Mm-hmm. God, I wish Shubanaki was here for that comment.
Were police functions. If you watch, I watched a couple movies from like the late 90s, early 2000s in the last couple weeks, like, and shows literally in the first like 5 minutes of each episode. I was watching like 6 Feet Under. I don't know if you've watched that show.
I have not, but
I made a comment that every time someone died, they were smoking a cigarette. And also the late 90s, that was an early 2000s show. It was a show that the guy from Dexter got started on, but like also the late 90s, like the big personality sin for one of Nick Cage's movies was that he secretly smoked. Like, that's a police function. It's showing people that this is bad. You shouldn't be doing this. We're going to make a moral character judgment on you. So that's what he's talking about. It's not necessarily repressive in what we consider repressive, but it is repressive because it's telling people they have to act a certain way.
The right will call you repressive for it, and they'll say they don't want to get canceled.
Well, the right will call anything repressive. So,
all right. Do you want to pick up on the next section?
Yeah. Some theoretical and practical aspects of economism. Economism, theoretical movement for free trade, theoretical syndicalism. It is to be seen to what extent theoretical syndicalism originated from Marxism and how far from the economic doctrines of free trade, i.e., in the last analysis, from liberalism. And therefore, it is to be seen whether economism, in its most complete form, is not a direct offspring of liberalism and had even in its origins very little relationship with Marxism, a relation at any rate of an extrinsic and purely verbal kind. The standpoint of the movement for free trade is based on a theoretical error whose practical origin it is not difficult to identify, on the distinction that is between political society and civil society, which from being a methodological distinction becomes and is presented as an organic distinction. Thus, it is asserted that economic activity concerns civil society and that the state must not intervene in its regulation. But as in actual reality, civil society and the state are identified, it must be settled that even liberalism is a form of quote-unquote regulation of a state kind, introduced and maintained by means of legislation and coercion. See, this is exactly what I was meaning by he's using these terms fundamentally different than how we conceive of them today.
Are you saying there was some shut up and let the book read there?
No, because he's talking about something else. So,
well, okay, fair.
It was a good clarification that we had. It is an act of will conscious of its own ends, and not the spontaneous automatic expression of an economic act. Therefore, liberalism is a political program destined to change insofar as it triumphs the leading personnel of the state and the economic program of the state itself. In other words, to alter the distribution of the national income. The case of theoretical syndicalism is different in that it relates to a subordinate group, which is prevented by this theory from ever becoming dominant, of developing beyond the economic cooperative phase in order to raise itself to the phase of ethico-political hegemony in civil society and of domination in the state. As far as liberalism is concerned, it is a case of a fraction of the ruling group which wants to modify not the structure of the state, but only the direction of the government, which wants to reform commercial legislation and only indirectly industrial legislation. Since it is undeniable that protection, especially in countries with a poor and restricted market, limits freedom of industrial initiative and unhealthily favors the origin of monopolies. It is a question of a rotation of the leading parties in the government, not of the foundation and organization of a new political society, even less of a new type of civil society. In the theoretical syndicalist movement, the question arises in a more complex form. It is undeniable that in the independence and autonomy of the subordinate group, which it professes to express, are in fact sacrificed to intellectual hegemony of the ruling group, precisely because syndicalism is only an aspect of liberalism justified by a few mutilated and therefore banal quotations from Marxism. Jesus.
This is childish. Get it the fuck out of here. I love that Gramsci.
Why and how does this quote-unquote sacrifice come about? The transformation of the subordinate into the ruling group is excluded either because the problem is not even seen, Fabianism, demand, an important part of the Labour Party, or because it is presented in inconsistent and ineffective ways, social democratic tendencies in general, or because an immediate leap from a class regime to one of perfect equality and syndical economic, is postulated. The standpoint of economism towards expressions of will, of action, and of political and intellectual initiative, as if these were a necessary emanation of economics, and moreover, the sole effective expression of the economy, is, to say the least, strange. Thus, it is inconsistent that the concrete posing of the question of hegemony should be interpreted as a fact which subordinates the hegemonious group. The fact of hegemony undoubtedly presupposes that the interests and strivings of the groups over which the hegemony will be exercised or taken account of, that a certain balance of compromises be formed, and that, in other words, the leading group makes some sacrifices of oh God, I hate it when he does this stuff. Of an economico-corporative kind.
There we go.
But it is also undoubted that these sacrifices and compromises cannot concern essentials, since if the hegemony is ethico-political, it must also be economic. It must have its foundation in the decisive function that the leading group exercises in the decisive sphere of economic activity.
So, jab at the economism. There's this racism is just to divide us so they can lower your wages thing. It's like, it's a little more than that, buddy. Some like dry personal financial interest of every ruling class person when people lean on economism rather than like realizing that there's an economic interest at heart that upholds their class. And there's a lot of economic interest in history and motivation for these things. But there's other things. Basically, it boils down to power.
If you just talk to your racist uncle or dad and tell him it doesn't economically make sense, he'll magically stop being racist.
Right.
Economism presents itself in many other different forms besides liberalism and theoretical syndicalism. All forms of electoral abstention belong to it. A typical example is the abstention of the Italian clericals after 1870, which steadily diminished after 1900 until 1919 and the formation of the Popular Party. The distinction which the clericals made between real Italy and legal Italy was a reproduction of the distinction between economic and the political legal world. And there are many forms of electoral, and he's referring to the fact that after Italy unified, the Pope declared all of Italy an apostasy, and the president of Italy excommunicated person. And in 1919, Mussolini cut a deal with the Pope and said, "We'll give you the Vatican, and you have to unexcommunicate me."
Nice.
And that's what he, yeah. That's why the Vatican City exists today, as it is.
As is its own political institution and technically not part of Italy. Nice.
Yeah. Thanks, that's, Mussolini.
Thanks, Mussolini.
And there are many, and there are many forms of electoral abstentionism, since there can also be semi-abstention, abstention, quarter abstention, etc. Abstention is linked with the formula, quote, so much the worse, so much the better, end quote, and also the formula of the so-called parliamentary intransigence of some groups of deputies. Economism is not always against political action in the political party, but the latter is considered as merely an educational organization of a syndical type. One point of reference for the study of economism and for the understanding of the relationship between structure and superstructure is the passage, is that passage from the Poverty Philosophy, where Marx says that an important phase in the development of the social group is that in which the single components of a trade union do not struggle any longer only for their own economic interests, but for the defense and development of that organization itself. See the exact statement in Poverty and Philosophy.
By the way, Poverty Philosophy, off the dome. Check it out.
The Poverty and Philosophy is, and this is the footnote for footnote 27, see the exact statement, Poverty and Philosophy. The Poverty and Philosophy, Poverty of Philosophy is an essential stage in the formation of Marxism. It can be considered as a development of the theses on Feuerbach, whereas the Holy Family is an indistinct intermediate phase of a haphazard origin, as appears from the parts dedicated to Proudhon, and especially to French materialism. The section on French materialism is more than anything else a chapter in the history of the culture, and is not theoretical, as it has often been interpreted. And as culture, and as a history of culture, it is admirable. Remember the observation that the criticism of Proudhon and his interpretation of the Hegelian dialectic and the Poverty of Philosophy can be extended to Gioberti and to the Hegelianism of the moderate Italian liberals in general. The parallel Proudhon-Gioberti, although they represent historical political phases which are not homogeneous, or rather precisely because of this, may be interesting and fertile. This bastard.
I know.
Just like, hey, I came up with a great theoretical research question for anyone who wants to...
Why don't you go research that? You have an assignment. Signed, Antonio.
This should be remembered, and now we're out of the footnote and back to the main text. This should be remembered together with Engels' statement that only in the last analysis is the economy the mainspring of history. In his two letters on Marxism, published also in Italian, this is just Marx Engels Selected Works, English edition, page 443-445. And taken together with the passage in the preface to the Critique of Political Economy, where it says that it is in the field of ideologies that men become aware of the conflict which takes place in the economic world. On various occasions, it has been stated that in these notes that Marxism is much more widespread than is generally conceded. The assertion is correct if what is meant is that historical economism is widespread, as Professor Loria now calls his more or less clumsy conceptions, and that therefore the cultural environment has completely changed from the time when Marxism began its struggles. It could be said, in Crotian terminology, that the greatest heresy arisen from the womb of the quote-unquote religion of liberty has also, like Orthodox religion, suffered degeneration, has been propagated as superstition, i.e. it has entered into a combination with liberalism and produced economism. But it should be seen whether, while the Orthodox religion has shriveled up, the heretical superstition has not always maintained a ferment which will give it a new birth as a higher religion. Whether that is the slag of superstition can easily be liquidated. Good Lord.
Yeah, and that is a good spot as any to stop. I do really like the use of pointing out that Engels says in the preface to Critique of the Political Party that it's in the field of ideologies that men become aware of conflict which take place in the economic world. Because that's a really concise way to say that, you know, economics are behind it, but it's not that functional, right? You know, even sometimes we make some correct observations, but oversimplify them, like, you know, all war be for oil, which started, we were talking about John Stuart before, that kind of started in liberalism, right? Certainly, natural resources are a major motivation of colonialism, and you could see the value of oil and how important oil is. But even with oil specifically, not only is that not the only natural resource, and not every war is about natural resource, they're about maintaining power and hegemony over other countries as an entity. That way, you know, the people that run or in the ruling class of your country are all the more powerful. It's kind of what colonialism has always been. That, you know, the petrodollar is really, like, people say, oh, the U.S. is a fiat currency because they're, you know, libertarian or whatever the fuck, or people just don't care. But when it came off gold and then got real fucking strong, it's and one of the big things that allows the U.S. to sanction and kind of be the economic standard of the world is the petrodollar. So that's why you see that, and of course the function of oil that gives it that value, are kind of the two driving forces for all of that. But obviously it's much more than that, and people are animated to that. You know, like, you're not going to go to racist uncle and say, hey, you know, they got oil in Iraq, go support the, you know, pro empire, right? These guys are pro empire because they were told America is the greatest thing ever, and they're so American, and they've been attacked, and they've got to get them Muslims that have attacked them. You know, shit like that, right? Like, ideology drives change, and it's centrally a big driver of history, if not the driver of history. But what matters is, do the conditions let those ideologies succeed? And what ideologies are those conditions spurring? But it's not just, like, you know, a like for like. Like, you've got a nice little, you know, lay out a graph of all the things that matter to someone, and they add it up and say, economically, this is my ideology. It's not how it fucking works. It's much more complex than that. But with all that said, this has been Mark's Madness Pod, part of Chunkaluta Network. We read books. There's a number of ways to get a hold of us. Do you want to say something else before we close out, Press?
No, I thought you were going to say your name, and then I say my name.
Oh, yeah. No, I've got to do the outro.
I didn't realize you were going to do the sign off first.
Yeah, I got to do that. So there's a number of ways to get a hold of us. At Mark's Madness Pod on Twitter, at Chunkaluta.org on Twitter, for Press directly, at MarksyMarks2. all of that, as well as links to the fundraisers. Right now we're focusing on the GoFundMe, the winter drive. But, you know, there's constant fundraisers for anything from getting trailers of supplies in to housing people to keep them warm on Piton Ridge that are always going on. You can check that out in the link tree, linktr.ee/Chunkaluta Network. It will have a link to social media, as well as a link to, you know, all of the fundraisers and campaigns. But that's all in Linktree, linktr.ee. You can also get a hold of Mark's Madness on Discord. Link should be in the Twitter bio, or, you know, email us on Gmail if you need the link, if it's not working and I can update it. Otherwise, you know, there is a Patreon, which helps support monthly, so we can, you know, pay people for the work they do, editing, things like that. and pay for Shugmani to basically to live. They don't live on a whole lot, but they need something to survive. So that's all in the Patreon. And that of course gives you access to, the Chunkaluta Discord as well. With that being said, my name is David. Now you go press.
For some reason, whenever I went to hit the quick key, my browser was being stupid. I'm Prez.
And we will talk to you next week. Bye.
Bye.